Mr. G, Judge Duncan, and Judge Keith. I'm here on behalf of myself. My wife is also here, who is an appellant, Ms. Rivera.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I would like to start by addressing the jurisdiction issue that the motion that the government filed. I think the motion that I did file, the response was pretty detailed, but I would just like to emphasize that Rule 10, the case law, and even Ryder Miller, Federal Practice, it's very clear on the fact that this is not the place and the time to be filing that type of documents. This is not an instance court that had to be done at the district court at this level. So that's the mere fact that the court accepted the motion with the attachment is contrary to law. This is not the right place to do that. If the government had an argument to that, they had plenty of time more than 2 years ago to do so. This is not the right time. And even if the court were to disagree with me, there's nothing, even accepting those attachments on the record, saying anything as to a mailing date.
You're talking about the statute of limitations.
Correct, Your Honor, as to 6 months. The true issue is whether or not it was mailed more than 6 months before we filed the complaint. And there's nothing, even with those attachments on the record, that specifies that there was a mailing date 6 months or more before that. Even if the letter, the attachment, has a date, that doesn't show that there was a mailing date of 6 months or more. Having said that, unless the court has any questions as to that, I will proceed with the rest of my argument, which is basically what I have on my briefs, which are pretty detailed, Your Honor. I will start with the res judicata issue. First of all, I mean, with all due respect to the district court, the court either didn't understand the complaints and the record, or it was just plainly biased. Because the complaint and the record is pretty clear as to everything that I'm saying here. First of all, as to privity, there were two cases below, right? On the first one, I filed a lawsuit against the judges on their personal capacity, not the FTCA, the Federal Tort Claims Act. On the second time around, I filed similar. I took away some defendants, and then I added the United States government. So the judges and the prosecutors were there on their individual capacities and as representatives of the United States, and the United States was also a party. So the case law is clear that in that type of situations, there is no privity, Your Honor. So there cannot be res judicata to start with. And then going into the other matter as to the merits and the jurisdiction, on the first case, if there is no jurisdiction, the court could not have gone into the merits because the court does not have authority, no matter what it says. With all due respect, it's worth nothing. It's just their opinion. So there's plenty of case laws to that, Your Honor. There's the restatement of the laws, and the district court tried to distinguish our case and trying to say that the case of Nationwide applied to our situation. But if she had looked at the record, she could have easily determined that our case is not similar to Nationwide at all. This is the first time that we put our feet on a court of law as to this matter. So how could she say that Nationwide applied to our situation? I mean, in the case of Nationwide, there were hearings. There was almost a case. I mean, was fully litigated. In our case, nothing happened. Nothing. Not the first time around, not the second time around. So how could it be on the merits? How could a judge determine that even though there was no jurisdiction, and even though there were no hearings at all, that this matter was litigated on the merits? Makes no sense to me. So I don't know. Maybe the government has a better argument. And similar thing with collateral estoppel, Your Honor. Same thing, no issue preclusion here, for the same reasons, basically. Now, going into the immunity issues, first of all, we filed a lawsuit against the judges in two capacities. First, when they acted as judges. And when did they act as judges? We accept that they acted as judges when in their disciplinary proceedings against me. So they acted as judges. So there's case law that says that they're absolutely immune in that type of situations. So we have no arguments to that at this moment. Maybe later on we'll figure out.
You made that argument to preserve it for...
Well, just in case for the Supreme Court, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. But not in all instances they acted as judges. At least that's my argument. Because whenever they deal with this CJA, and the judges here know about it, because I guess you also deal with the CJA and paying attorneys and that type of things, they're not acting as judges. The attorneys are not parties in the case. So they cannot be acting as judges.
Do you have any authority for that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Do you have any authority
for that? The ones I cited on my brief, which I think is a case from the 8th Circuit, I think it's Johnson, I'm not sure, but Vince Johnson, which states that that's the situation, that when judges deal with CJA matters, they act as administrators. So if they're acting as administrators, they're not acting as judges, and there's no absolute immunity. So under those circumstances, when they act as administrators, the first thing the district court had to do was to determine whether or not the judges in Puerto Rico were acting in that capacity. They had to bring evidence into the record to see how judges in Puerto Rico deal with CJA matters to start with. The district court judge did not even do that. So as to the prosecutors, similar thing. Of course, prosecutors have qualified immunity when they act as prosecutors, when they prosecute a case, when they decide whether or not to prosecute this person or not, whether or not there's probable cause, and so forth and so on. But where does it say that what the prosecutors were trying to did and were trying to do against me are functions of a prosecutor? What did I have to do with them? I was the attorney in a case. Why did they have to be asking for information again about me, about my financial situation, my tax returns, and whether or not I owe money to anybody, that type of thing? That's not their function. They're not prosecutors when they do that. So if they're not prosecutors when they do that, then they are not protected by qualified immunity. Then I want to move on as to also the district court judge on the second time around did not even, I don't know, understand the complaint or read it properly or whatever. The thing is, like, she's saying that, oh, all your claims are for intentional actions. Well, that's not so. Just by simple reading of the complaint shows that I said intentionally and or negligently. I believe, and it's just a belief, and that some of the judges acted intentionally. Judge Wustin, for example, who presided over the whole matter. I think he acted intentionally. But as to those that acted intentionally, I filed my lawsuit for a violation of state laws, not the FTCA. When they acted negligently, and I believe that some of the other judges did, because they just let it be. They did not interfere with the whole matter. When they acted negligently, then the FTCA does apply. And finally, even if none of this is accepted, there's also the option of injunctive relief, which I did ask in my complaint. The judge didn't know anything about it, and I think I was entitled to it, at least to an extent. And I think my briefs are pretty detailed, and my argument is that I don't have anything for the Honor. Unless you have something else, that would be it for me.
Well, you have time for rebuttal.
Yes, please, Your Honor, just in case.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Baldwin?
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
My name is Joseph Baldwin. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the District of Maryland, and I represent the United States and the individual defendant appellee.
Why did it take you so long to figure out that there might be a statute of limitations problem?
Your Honor, I was reviewing the file in preparation for oral argument, and frankly, the attachments to the complaint were in the correspondence file, and the actual briefing file that's normally referred to for looking into the case file, it wasn't in there, and that's what I had looked at initially, and it wasn't online. So until I went to the correspondence file and went back to the absolute end and saw that it was there with the envelope that showed that it was sent with a complaint, I just didn't know that was the case. And frankly, when I first found that page, I assumed that it had been, that it was part of the docket. I didn't look back to make sure, and I didn't become aware of that until last Monday, which actually after I apprised Mr. Zeno of the fact that I'd be moving for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. May it please the court. The district court correctly dismissed all claims in this action and should be affirmed for two reasons, although there are additional reasons. The first is the complaint purports to state claims in tort. To the extent that the complaint states a claim in tort at all, they're intentional torts or torts arising from intentional torts and therefore are not cognizable under the FTCA. Second, the complaint purports to seek injunctive relief. The appellants have not identified a jurisdictional basis for the granting of injunctive relief. The FTCA does not allow for injunctive relief. They have not identified any other basis, nor have they stated a claim for injunctive relief. As, for instance, they have not alleged that there is a lack of legal remedies. And I'll address these each in turn, Your Honor. With respect to the intentional tort claims and the tort claims in general, these claims are really in three buckets. There's one that regards CJA payments, which is the first cause of action. There's a second set of claims that have to do with the disciplinary proceedings, which now Mr. Zeno has conceded that the judges have judicial immunity for, so really those claims should fall out of this action. And third, there are the claims that are mainly against prosecutors, but two judges are mentioned in two of the claims in claims clauses of action 6, 7, and 8. Turning to the CJA payment claims, there's no claim sounding a tort there, with the possible exception of abuse of process, presumably for withholding or delaying payments. And that would be an intentional tort claim that is accepted under the FTCA. In order to find otherwise, what would happen otherwise if, as Mr. Zeno argues, that he alleged that some were malicious and some were not malicious, i.e., some were negligent? Basically, what he'd be saying is there's a common law tort for an action against a federal judge, even assuming, as he's saying, acting in administrative capacity, if that judge delays payment under CJA. And he hasn't pointed to any common law tort that would support a negligence claim, and it simply doesn't sound in negligence. With respect to the disciplinary proceedings in the CJA panel, as I said previously, he has conceded here that there's immunity for the judges there, and so those claims would drop out. But additionally, to the extent that there would be tort claims there, those would also be intentional. Furthermore, this is nothing more than an attempt to go behind what was already done, the disciplinary proceedings in the District of Puerto Rico and the First Circuit, and collaterally attack essentially the disciplinary proceedings. What he seeks here, the relief that he's identified, is that he wants to undo what the disciplinary punishment was, and he's seeking to do that in this court and in a district court in this circuit instead of appealing that, for instance, to the Supreme Court of the United States. And finally, the third bucket is the prosecutor claims. And on those claims, very quickly, one is where he makes a conclusory allegation that there was some Sixth Amendment issue. He has an attorney in the case, appears to be asserting that the Sixth Amendment right, which is not his to assert, it would be his client's, and now he's trying to assert it afterwards. To the extent he's asserting that there's some tortious interference with contract, he certainly hasn't described any facts at all with respect to that claim. And in any event, a tortious interference with contract is specifically identified in the Federal Torts Claim Act.
I actually had a factual question, if I could take you to the preclusion arguments.
Yes,
for just a moment. The district court equated this case to Stebbins because it said that this was plaintiff's third attempt to litigate related claims and referenced a 2007 case. Can you tell me what three attempts were? Because I was having trouble finding three.
Your Honor, I believe the district court, Chief Judge Chastain, was referring to the disciplinary proceedings to the extent that some of the relief that he was seeking here was basically similar to the relief that he was seeking in the disciplinary proceedings. I don't think that what was done in the disciplinary proceedings covers everything that he has addressed in the case that was filed before Judge Massetti or that went to Chief Judge Chastain.
And you may be proceeding in the direction of talking about Stebbins, and if so, I'll wait. But I did have a couple of questions in that regard.
Yes, Your Honor, I could address Stebbins now if you have a question.
Stebbins involved what looked like bad faith, what one might characterize as bad faith. It isn't the government's position that's present here, is it?
Your Honor, that in Stebbins, you're referring to the fact that a letter was, the EO letter had not been issued once they had been through the trial. No, Your Honor, I don't think there's, it's not our position, and I don't have grounds at this time to say that there was bad faith. That's not the government's position, this argument.
And also, the Stebbins exception generally kicks in by its terms when there's a manifest injustice, where manifest injustice would otherwise result in. Here it appears that the burden that you would face is just that one relitigation. What is your argument with respect to the applicability of Stebbins on these facts?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, in Stebbins, as you know, there was quote unquote a full blown trial in the hearing with respect to the Title VII EEO matter, and that is different than our facts, obviously. But what we have here is a issue where immunity was asserted. Immunity is supposed to be dealt with up front. We got as far as you're supposed to get with immunity.
On a motion to dismiss.
Your Honor, bringing the motion, you're allowed to bring immunity at the earliest time. You should bring it at the earliest time. And that's when we asserted the immunity.
So you usually do it at a motion to dismiss as opposed to a motion for summary judgment.
Your Honor, I have... Certainly, there is case law that says that it's a summary judgment issue and it's asserted as an affirmative defense, but I couldn't see anywhere that it said that you couldn't assert it on a motion to dismiss. So it was asserted as a motion to dismiss, and there was briefing, and certainly the case law also states that there is...
I think the appellant's argument, if I understand it correctly, is that he never had the opportunity to make an immunity argument contrary to the government's representations in the motion to dismiss, unlike in Stebbins, where you had full opportunity to make that argument.
Yes, Your Honor, but immunity is immunity from suit. It's immunity from discovery. It's not as if he would have had the opportunity to have discovery on an immunity question. He has pleaded facts in his complaint and, you know, asserted that's sufficient for him to, you know, to get into court, knowing that there's going to be, and particularly in this case, where he's already had an immunity issue and he's kept the same allegations in the complaint against judges and federal prosecutors.
My question, though, was in the context of Stebbins, where the defendant did go through a full-blown trial, and as you're acknowledging, that's not the case here. You've not been required to participate in anything equivalent to a trial on the merits.
That's true, Your Honor.
So how does Stebbins help you, is my question.
Well, Stebbins applies, Your Honor, to the extent that qualified immunity and absolute immunity are to be addressed first chance as possible, and there would not be an opportunity to go to a full-blown trial in an ordinary course on an immunity question.
Well, just for purposes of argument, if we were to assume that the res judicata argument was not successful for you, why don't you talk to us about the collateral estoppel?
Yes, Your Honor. On the collateral estoppel argument, first I want to note that with the Ritter case that that Chief Judge Chastanow is holding is based on essentially looks at a case in which there was a determination in front of a judge, and then it came back after appeal, and it was held that collateral estoppel was going to be applied within the same case itself. And that's how the government understands Chief Judge Chastanow's ruling here, and we think would apply. Essentially, this is the same case, but for the fact that FTCA claims were added here. And that would be the applicability. Say it's the same case, it's the same complaint, it's the same parties, essentially, with the exception the United States was added. And in fact, to address one point that Mr. Zeno addressed, that is that the notion that there is no privity in the first case is not the case. He had made a claim for an injunction in the first case, basically that would have sought to direct, under his theory, the administrative aspect of the courts to take some action on his behalf. So that could have only been under an official capacity. So there would have been privity in the first case and certainly in the second. He has a,
as I understand his argument, he may not understand it. He contends that by adding the FTCA claims, that cures his defects, at least as far as venue and personal jurisdiction.
Your Honor, I don't think that's the case. Adding an FTCA claim would not change the personal jurisdiction of the court over the individual defendants in their individual capacity. The court would have to address that defendant by defendant on the merits, and that was something that was determined by Judge Massetti in the first instance, and found that there was a minimum contact analysis, in fact, that there was not personal jurisdiction. Mr. Zeno has, in his brief, conceded at page 30 that by referencing the restatement of judgments, where it speaks to the fact that collateral estoppel does apply when personal jurisdiction has been found in the same court, and you return to the same district court, and you've got the same parties in front of you, personal jurisdiction would apply there. So it's not the case with respect to personal jurisdiction.
Well, if we were to disagree with the appellant with regard to his FTCA claims, does that make your collateral estoppel argument stronger or weaker in those actions?
Your Honor, I think that with respect to, I'm not sure that it has, it would be not notionally stronger, Your Honor, because I don't think believe there are any valid FTCA claims here. It's essentially the same claims that were brought before. And it's all of the same claims asserted in exactly the same way, setting aside the FTCA claims. But if I could turn to where I left off in terms of the statement of claim issues, in order to, if you look at each of these claims, there just simply hasn't been a statement of a claim, of a valid claim here. And Mr. Zeno's contention that if he doesn't have it under the FTCA, then he's got it under state law. As he said in his briefs, well, if we don't have intentional torts under the FTCA, then we're going to have it under state law. That's just not the case. That's not how the FTCA works. He's not going to have a claim against these people under state law. Plus, he has to identify some common law torts, some negligence common law torts that would apply against these defendants under the FTCA, whatever that remnant is, and he has not done that. So the United States would submit there is not even, but before you get to res judicata, before you get anywhere, and just look in the four corners of this complaint, and you look at the allegations that have been made here, there has not been a claim stated here that can be brought against these defendants. And to the extent there is one in any of these places, there are intentional torts. Regardless of how it may be characterized in the complaint, there are no factual allegations that would support anything other than an intentional tort, if that. And those are clearly precluded under the FTCA. Moving to the issue of the injunction, as I said, Messina has not identified a jurisdictional basis for the injunction. It cites to the Pulliam case, and there's a couple cites to the Pulliam case there. Pulliam case is a 1983 case. It subsequently Congress amended 1983, said it should not have declaratory relief or injunctive relief against a judge, only in certain circumstances that don't apply here. Other than that, there's been no, he has not pointed to a place that would allow him to have injunctive relief against the judges here. Furthermore, like I said, he hasn't alleged that he didn't have an adequate remedy of law. Certainly in the disciplinary proceedings, there was another appeal that was not taken there. Under the CJA, he could have filed a writ of mandamus if he thought that, even assuming the fact, as he says, that this is an administrative action, it's not a judicial one. If that's the case, he could have filed a writ of mandamus to have done what he says was undone. And he didn't do that, and there's no allegation that that he attempted to. Just to briefly address a couple other points, with respect to immunity, he has made concessions here with respect to the damages claims, with respect to disciplinary proceedings, which I believe are 3 and 5. With respect to the judges that are named in the causes of action on 6 and 7, those judges were granting a continuance, and it's not clear what the judge is doing with respect to the Sixth Amendment claim, where we don't believe the claim has been stated at all. But certainly, granting continuance is a typical judicial function, and the judge should have absolute immunity there. With respect to the prosecutors, Mr. Zeno has not framed a complaint or made allegations that would allow us to determine, in the first instance, precisely what it is that he is objecting to. He said here at oral argument that there was the issue of continuance. The fact that the prosecutors requested a continuance within the course of the judicial proceedings, either within their absolute immunity or certainly with their discretion, and the fact that they went to the court to ask for it, it doesn't suggest any abuse. To the extent he still thinks there's an abuse, it's aside from the immunity issue, it would be under the FTCA, clearly. And finally, he also talks about the about looking into his personal finances, although the fact that he's alleged in his briefs nowhere come close to what was alleged in the complaint itself, where he says that there was some discoveries sought basically into his finances. Though that was a motion based looking inside the four sides of the complaint that were addressed to the court. And from what I understand from his brief, from his briefings, in the case, it wasn't granted. The prosecutors went to the court, so there was no issue of due process. They simply asked for something and were denied it, as I understand it. And that certainly doesn't make out a claim. To the extent it was, again, and the FTCA would be a claim for an intentional tort. That's all I have, Your Honor, if you have no more questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Baldwin. Mr. Zeno?
Now it seems that I have a couple more things than before. Let me start by trying to clarify what the prosecutor is trying to unclarify. And the disciplinary proceedings were one thing, and this case is another thing. On this case, I'm the plaintiff. In that case, those disciplinary proceedings were against me. Whether or not they were correct or not, this is not the place where I'm using.
But that's the is that the 2007 hearing that the district court was referring to, the disciplinary proceedings?
No. Not at all, Your Honor. Not at all. The disciplinary proceedings, there are two published opinions as to them. I don't disagree. I don't agree with them, of course, but that's something separate. They suspended me from the court for 3 months. They put me out of the CJ panel. That's one thing. That was their chance. Now, this is a cause of action against the judges from me. I'm claiming that there was malice and negligence and or negligence in this matter. I may be wrong. I may be right. But that's why there's a district court to try to prove that. This has nothing, the disciplinary proceedings, actually, in the disciplinary proceedings, I never put my feet in the court as to that because they never granted me a hearing. I was never allowed to have discovery. So even if they're going to use that, I think that, that's one of the opportunities that I had to litigate this matter. Even then, I never had a fair chance to do anything as to it. So they imposed their discipline on me without giving me any chance to do discovery, to have a hearing or any of that. So that's why I'm filing this lawsuit. So I filed a lawsuit, I think, I don't remember, it was 2007, the first time around. And I did not file under the FTCA. I made a mistake as to that. There wasn't any bad faith. It's just that I'm not an expert on civil matters, on FTCA or any of that. I'm a criminal attorney, a federal criminal attorney. So the judge determined that I had no, there was no personal jurisdiction because they claimed there were no minimum contacts, so forth and so on. And so it, he dismissed it. So fine. So then I go and fully comply with the FTCA and refile the thing, which is what the law and the case law and the restatement says that I should have done. I did file a notice of appeal, but then I realized the best thing to do was just to have the appeal dismissed and go again with the district court with full jurisdiction this time. So the disciplinary proceedings have nothing to do with this. I mean, of course there is a relation, but that was not a, it's not one of the cases in this matter. Okay? And let me go. Just 1 second, Your Honor. So the Stebbins versus Nationwide case is not applicable in this matter, Your Honor. It's very different from our situation. Let me go through one of my notes here. Okay, as to the attachment that the government recently filed, there's nothing in the record saying that this attachment was ever filed. So the court should not draw any type of inferences trying to find that there was an attachment ever. So it was not part of the record. The first time that it comes to the record is when the government recently filed it. Okay? So even if that's what's being used to claim that I have no jurisdiction, that the court had no jurisdiction because of the statute of limitations, that was never part of the file, of the record. And, okay, let me see, just 1 second, Your Honor. I have so many notes. Okay, as to the Pullian case, I think it's the Pullian case. The government claims that the Pullian case is not applicable anymore because of Section 1983 was amended and so forth and so on. But this case was not filed under Section 1983. This case was filed under the FTCA, which is a whole different thing. And the government claims that I have not a right to injunctive relief and that I have not proven that I have a right to that. Well, they have never shown any law or case law showing that I do not have that right. I don't think I have to prove to them that I have a right to injunctive relief. Everybody has a right to injunctive relief in any case. Okay? So I don't have to prove to them, show them a law specifically saying that I have a right to injunctive relief. The fact is that there's no law saying that I don't have it. And 1983 does not apply here. As to my claim of against the prosecutors, my main claim against them has to do with, I'm sorry, Your Honor, my time is over, so.
Finish your sentence.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Okay, it says to, they claim that my main concern is with the, that they don't know what is it I really have against the prosecutors. Well, what I have against the prosecutors is that when I tried to defend this person for free, pro bono, they started trying to go into my things, asking me for tax returns, asking me for my financial documents. I think that's pretty much it's harassment. So that's my matter against the government, Your Honor, the prosecutors. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
We will come down and greet counsel and proceed directly to the last case.